Chapter 39. In the porch the bishop waited, impressive as ever in his white and gold dalmatic, against the red robes of the chapter. Preceded by two chamberlains, Odo mounted the steps amid the sudden silence of the people. The great bronze portals of the cathedral, which were never opened save on occasions of state, swung slowly inward, pouring a wave of music and incense out upon the hushed sunlit square. Then they closed again, engulfing the brilliant procession, the duke, the bishop, the clergy and the court, and leaving the populace to scatter in search of the diversions prepared for them at every street corner. It was not till late that night that the new duke found himself alone. He had withdrawn at last from the torch-lit balcony overlooking the square, whither the shouts of his subjects had persistently recalled him. Silence was falling on the illuminated streets, and the dimness of midnight upon the sky through which rocket after rocket had torn its brilliant furrows. In the palace a profounder stillness reigned. Since his accession, Odo, out of respect for the late duke, had lodged in one of the wings of the great building, but tradition demanded that he should henceforth inhabit the ducal apartments, and thither, at the close of the day's ceremonies, his gentleman had conducted him. Tresker had asked permission to wait on him before he slept, and he knew that the Prime Minister would be kept late by his conference with the secret police, whose nightly report could not be handed in till the festivities were over. Meanwhile, Odo was in no mood for sleep. He sat alone in the closet, still hung with saints' images and jeweled reliquaries, where his cousin had so often given him audience, and whence, through the open door, he could see the embroidered curtains and plumed baldachin of the state bed which was presently to receive him. All day his heart had beat with high ambitions, but now a weight sank upon his spirit. The reaction from the tumultuous welcome of the streets to the closely guarded silence of the palace made him feel how unreal was the fancied union between himself and his people, how insuperable the distance that tradition and habit had placed between them. In the narrow closet, where his predecessor had taken refuge from the detested task of reigning, the new duke felt the same moral lassitude steal over him. How was such a puny will as his to contend against the great forces of creed and prejudice? All the influences arrayed against him, tradition, superstition, the lust of power, the arrogance of race, seemed concentrated in the atmosphere of that silent room, with its guarded threshold, its pious relics, and lying on the desk in the embrasure of the window, the manuscript litany which the late duke had not lived to complete. Oppressed by his surroundings, Odo rose and entered the bedchamber. A lamp burned before the image of the Madonna at the head of the bed, and two lighted flambeaux flanked the picture of the Last Judgment on the opposite wall. Odo remembered the look of terror which the Duke had fixed on the picture during their first strange conversation. A praying stool stood beneath it, and it was said that here, rather than before the Virgin's image, the melancholy prince performed his private devotions. The horrors of the scene were depicted with a childish minuteness of detail, as though the painter had sought to produce an impression of moral anguish by the accumulation of physical sufferings. And just such puerile images of the wrath to come may have haunted the mysterious recesses of the Duke's imagination. Crescent, I had told Odo how the dying man's thoughts had seemed to center upon this dreadful subject, and how again and again, amid his ravings, he had cried out that the picture must be burned, as though the sight of it was become intolerable to him. Odo's own mind, across which the events and emotions of the day still threw the fantastic shadows of an expiring illumination, was wrought to the highest state of impressionability. He saw in a flash all that the picture must have symbolized to his cousin's fancy, and in his desire to reconstruct that dying vision of fleshly retribution, he stepped close to the diptych, resting a knee on the stool beneath it. As he did so, the picture suddenly opened, disclosing the inner panel. Odo caught up one of the flambeaux, and in its light, as on a sunlit wave, there stepped forth to him the lost Venus of Georgian. He knew the picture in an instant. There was no mistaking the glow of the limbs, the midsummer languor of the smile, the magical atmosphere in which the gold of sunlight, of autumn leaves, of amber grapes, seemed fused by some lost alchemy of the brush. As he gazed, the scene changed, and he saw himself in a darkened room with cabalistic hangings. He saw Hela Jenstern's tall figure, towering in supernatural light, the Duke leaning eagerly forward, the Duchess with set lips and troubled eyes, the little prince bent wonderingly above the magic crystal. A step in the antechamber announced Tresker's approach. Odo returned to the cabinet and the minister advanced with a low bow. The two men had had time to grow accustomed to the new relation in which they stood to one another, yet there were moments when, to Odo, the past seemed to lie like fallen leaves beneath Tresker's steps. Donna Laura, fond and foolish in her weeds, Gamba, Mamola, and the pure featherhead Cerveno, dying at 19 of a distemper, because he had stood in the other's way. The impression was strong on him now, but it was only momentary. Habit reasserted itself, and the minister faced the man. Odo signed to Tresker to seat himself and the latter silently presented his report. He was a diligent and capable administrator, and however mixed might be the motives which attached him to his sovereign, they did not interfere with the exact performance of his duties. Odo knew this, and was grateful for it. He knew that Tresker, ambitious of the regency, had intrigued against him to the last. He knew that an intemperate love of power was the mainspring of that seemingly dispassionate nature. But death had crossed Tresker's schemes, and he was too adroit an opportunist not to see that his best chance now lay in making himself indispensable to his new sovereign. Of all this Odo was aware, but his own motives in appointing Tresker did not justify his looking for great disinterestedness in his minister. The irony of circumstances had forced them upon each other, and each knew that the other understood the situation, and was prepared to make the best of it. The Duke presently rose, and handed back to Tresker the reports of the secret police. They were the documents he most disliked to handle. "You have acquitted yourself admirably of your disagreeable duties," he said with a smile. I hope I have done as well. At any rate, the day is over." Tresker returned the smile, with his usual tinge of irony. Another has already begun," said he. "Ah," said Odo, with a touch of impatience, "are we not to sleep on our laurels?" Tresker bowed. "Austria, your highness, never sleeps." Odo looked at him with surprise. What do you mean?" "That I have to remind your highness of what?" Tresker had one of his characteristic pauses. "That the Duke of Monte Loro is in failing health, and that her highness's year of widowhood ended yesterday." There was a silence. Odo, who had reseated himself, rose and walked to the window. The shutters stood open, and he looked out over the formless obscurity of the gardens. Above the intervening masses of foliage the Borromei wing raised its vague gray bulk. He saw lights in Maria Clementina's apartments and wondered if she still waked. An hour or two earlier, as he had given him her hand in the contra dance at the State Ball. It was her first public appearance since the late Duke's death, and with the laying off of her weeds as he had regained something of her former brilliance eye. At the moment he had hardly observed her. As he had seemed a mere inanimate part of the pageant, of which he formed the throbbing center. But now the sense of her nearness pressed upon him. She seemed close to him, ingrained with his fate, and with the curious duality of vision that belongs to such moments he beheld her again as he had first shown on him the imperious child whom he had angered by stroking her spaniel, the radiant girl who had welcomed him on his return to Pianura. Tresker's voice aroused him. At any moment, the minister was saying, "Her Highness may fall heir to Monte Loro. It is the moment for which Austria waits. There is always an archduke ready, and Her Highness is still a young woman." Odo turned slowly from the window. I have told you that this is impossible," he murmured. Tresker looked down and thoughtfully fingered the documents in his hands. "Your Highness," said he, "is as well acquainted as your ministers with the difficulties that beset us. Monte Loro is one of the richest states in Italy. It is a pity to alienate such revenues from Pianura. The new duke was silent. His minister's words were merely an audible expression of his own thoughts. He knew that the future welfare of Pianura depended on the annexation of Monte Loro. He owed it to his people to unite the two sovereignties. At length he said, "Colin, you are building on an unwarrantable assumption." Tresca raised an interrogative glance. "You assume Her Highness's consent." The minister again paused, and his pause seemed to flash an ironical light on the poverty of the other's defenses. "I come straight from Her Highness," said he quietly, "and I assume nothing that I am not in a position to affirm." Odo turned on him with a start. "Do I understand that you have presumed?" His minister raised a deprecating hand. "Yes, sir," said he, "the Archduke's envoy is in Pianura." 4.2. Odo, on his return to Pianura, had taken it for granted that De Crucis would remain in his service. There had been little talk between the two on the way. The one was deep in his own wretchedness, and the other had to find a tact to intrude on it. But Odo felt the nearness of that penetrating sympathy which was almost a gift of divination. He was glad to have De Crucis at his side at a moment when any other companionship had been intolerable, and in the egotism of his misery he imagined that he could dispose as he pleased of his friend's future. After the little prince's death, however, De Crucis had at once asked permission to leave Pianura. He was perhaps not displeased by Odo's expressions of surprise and disappointment, but they did not alter his decision. He reminded the new duke that he had been called to Pianura as governor to the late heir, and that, death having cut short his task, he had now no farther pretext for remaining. Odo listened with a strange sense of loneliness. The responsibilities of his new state weighed heavily on the musing speculative side of his nature. Face to face with the sudden summons to action, with the necessity for prompt and not too curious choice of means and method, he felt a stealing apathy of the will, an inclination toward the subtle duality of judgment that had so often weakened and diffused his energies. At such a crisis it seemed to him that, De Crucis gone, he remained without a friend. He urged the abbate to reconsider his decision, begging him to choose a post about his person. De Crucis shook his head. "The offer," said he, "is more tempting to me than your highness can guess, but my business here is at an end, and must be taken up elsewhere. My calling is that of a pedagogue. When I was summoned to take charge of Prince Ferent's education, I gave up my position in the household of Prince Bracciano, not only because I believed that I could make myself more useful in training a future sovereign than the son of a private nobleman, but also," he added with a smile, "because I was curious to visit a state of which Your Highness had so often spoken, and because I believed that my residence here might enable me to be of service to Your Highness. In this I was not mistaken, and I will gladly remain in Pianura long enough to give Your Highness such counsels as my experience suggests, but that business discharged, I must ask leave to go." From this position, no entreaties could move him. And so fixed was his resolve, that it confirmed the idea that he was still a secret agent of the Jesuits. Strangely enough, this did not prejudice Odo, who was more than ever under the spell of De Crucis's personal influence. Though Odo had been acquainted with many professed philosophers, he had never met among them a character so nearly resembling the old stoical ideal of temperance and serenity, and he could never be long with De Crucis without reflecting that the training which could form and nourish so noble a nature must be other than the world conceived it. De Crucis, however, frankly pointed out that his former connection with the Jesuits was too well known in Pianura not to be an obstacle in the way of his usefulness. "I own," said he, "that before the late Duke's death I exerted such influence as I possessed to bring about Your Highness's appointment as regent, but the very connections that favored me with your predecessor must stand in the way of my serving Your Highness. Nothing could be more fatal to your prospects than to have it said that you had chosen a former Jesuit as your advisor. In the present juncture of affairs, it is needful that you should appear to be in sympathy with the liberals, and that whatever reforms you attempt should seem the result of popular pressure rather than of your own free choice. Such an attitude may not flatter the sovereign's pride, and is in fact merely a higher form of expediency, but it is one which the proudest monarchs of Europe are finding themselves constrained to take, if they would preserve their power and use it effectually. Soon afterward De Crucis left Pianura, but before leaving he imparted to Odo the result of his observations while in the late Duke's service. De Crucis's view was that of the more thoughtful men of his day who had not broken with the Church, yet were conscious that the whole social system of Europe was in need of renovation. The movement of ideas in France, and their rapid transformation into legislative measures of unforeseen importance, had as yet made little impression in Italy, and the clergy in particular lived in serene unconsciousness of any impending change. De Crucis, however, had been much in France, and had frequented the French churchmen, who, save in the highest ranks of the hierarchy, were keenly alive to the need of reform, and ready, in many instances, to sacrifice their own privileges in the public cause. These men, living in their provincial cures or abbeys, were necessarily in closer contact with the people, better acquainted with their needs and more competent to relieve them than the city demagogues theorizing in Parisian coffee houses on the rights of man and the code of nature. But the voice of the demagogues carried farther than that of the clergy, and such revolutionary notions as crossed the Alps had more to do with the founding of future utopias than with the remedy of present evils. Even in France, the temperate counsels of the clergy were being overruled by the sentimental imprudences of the nobles, and by the bluster of the politicians. It was to put Odo on his guard against these two influences that De Crucis was chiefly anxious. But the intelligent cooperation of the clergy was sadly lacking in his administrative scheme. He knew that Odo could not count on the support of the church party, and that he must make what use he could of the liberals in his attempts at reform. The clergy of Pianura had been in power too long to believe in the necessity of conceding anything to the new spirit. And since the banishment of the Society of Jesus, the presumption of the other orders had increased instead of diminishing. The priests, whatever their failings, had attached the needy by a lavish bounty, and they had a powerful auxiliary in the Madonna of the Mountain, who drew pilgrims from all parts of Italy, and thus contributed to the material welfare of the state as well as to its spiritual privileges. To the common people, their Virgin was not only a protection against disease and famine, but a kind of oracle, who by divers signs and tokens gave evidence of divine approval or displeasure, and it was naturally to the priests that the faithful looked for a reading of these phenomena. This gave the clergy a powerful hold on the religious sensibilities of the people, and more than once. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.